Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. As human-caused climate change continues to warm our planet with often disastrous results, it's easy to resign yourself to an attitude that the problem's just too big to tackle. But fortunately, there are smart people working on solutions that can potentially change our current climate trajectory. In this program, we'll learn about the world of biochar, biofuels, and the process called pyrolysis that can be used to remove carbon from the biogeochemical cycle and store it deep underground. Our guests are from Charm Industrial, headquartered in San Francisco with a research and development plant in Colorado. They're going to talk to us about how they remove carbon from the landscape through the process of bio-oil injection, sequestering the carbon deep in the earth. We'll learn about this process being carried out in Colorado with Joe Pollan, Director of Pyrolysis Engineering, and Nora Cohen-Brown, Charm Industrial's Head of Market Development and Policy. They join us now to share their innovative solutions to this consequential problem. Joe Pollan and Nora Cohen-Brown, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
So, Joe, you're the director of pyrolysis engineering, and we'll find out what that is. And Nora, you're the head of market development and policy. I'd like to start out with you, Nora. Just tell us a little bit about how you came into Charm Industrial and tell us about what this company does generally.
Yeah, so I run everything policy and regulatory, so that's a little bit of my lens on this. But Charm Industrial is a carbon removal company, and I've been at Charm for about 4 years. I'd already been working in the climate technology space after spending several years working in the White House and the Obama administration. And I really was interested in the idea of doing something very active on the climate problem, like really being able to dig in and come up with solutions. And Charm Industrial is in this very nascent space of trying to actively remove carbon from the atmosphere. And the other thing that's very unique about Charm is that we do it in a way that also takes advantage of underutilized resources. So we take biomass feedstocks, things like wildfire residues or agricultural residues that don't have another market and that currently rot or burn and therefore have, you know, emissions associated with them, but also cause other problems like wildfires or poor air quality. And we're able to utilize those residues that don't have another market in our process, which the process part of it, I'm really going to leave to Joe. But basically, once we process those feedstocks and we create a carbon-rich bio-oil, we store that oil permanently underground, and then we sell it in the voluntary carbon market. And we also continue to pursue a number of different applications for the oil that we produce so that we can also help create other industrial, improve other industrial processes by reducing their carbon footprint.
And Joe, tell us about your educational and career journey, because you come at this more from the science and engineering side.
Yeah, definitely. I got into pyrolysis back in 2009, and that was right after I finished my undergraduate degree in chemical engineering, and I got the research bug. I was working on a pilot scale pyrolyzer in our lab at UMass Amherst and started to do all of the, you know, experimentation with using forestry residues and agricultural residues and turning it into bio-oil and biochar. And it really motivated me to pursue graduate school after that. So after I worked as an undergrad research technician, I actually went to South Dakota State to pursue my master's in agricultural engineering. And then after getting that degree, I kept going further and obtained my PhD in mechanical engineering with a co-major in biorenewable resources and technology. So it's all been focused mostly on pyrolysis and pyrolysis products, specifically bio-oil and biochar. And it's been a pretty successful and, fulfilling journey to get to this point.
Okay, well, let's do a little biofuels, biochar 101 for folks like me that knew nothing about this before I first talked to you. Let's start with pyrolysis.
Yeah.
I know what pyro is. It's fire. Tell us what that process is and what it's used for.
Yeah, fast pyrolysis is a thermal conversion technology. So it's a thermochemical process where we heat up biomass, and biomass is anything that's plant material derived. It could be sawdust. It can be corn stalks and corn cobs. What we do is we heat it up very fast in a high temperature reactor to basically vaporize the wood or the corn stalks and the corn cobs. We vaporize everything to make all of this bio-oil, which is condensed out later in the process. If you think about pyrolysis like a campfire, the vapors are really the flames of a campfire, but they're burning mid-flight because they have so much access to oxygen in the local environment. And if you were to place a bunch of water on the campfire and you would have all these, your logs left over and it looks like charcoal, that's what we call biochar. It's the solid residue left over from this thermal conversion. We do make a third product from this process called syngas or synthesis gas. And it's a combination of leftover nitrogen, CO2, CO, a little bit of methane, a little bit of hydrogen, basically light gases that you would have to take to cryogenic temperatures to be able to condense them out. But there are remainder chemical compounds that are produced from the fracturing of biomass when it's being volatilized.
And one of the cool things about our process is actually that we take that gas that we produce and we reuse it to heat up the biomass that needs to be dried that we use in the process. So every part of what we create in the pyrolysis process does actually get used for carbon removal or within the process itself.
So very efficient.
Exactly.
And Joe, from my understanding and talking to you previously, you actually developed a new way and better way to do this. Can you tell us a bit about that in your background? Because I found that to be really interesting and inspiring.
Yeah, I was working at Iowa State University where I was pursuing my PhD. And I was always thinking about how are we going to get enough heat into the reactor when we scale this up to handle more and more thermal conversion of biomass. And I started to dabble with autothermal pyrolysis and doing some initial experiments where I admitted a small portion of air into the fluidizing gas stream in the reactor. And we use a fluidized bed reactor. So it's a vertical pipe. It has inert bed media inside it, like sand. And we'd use fluidizing gas to basically bubble up through the sand, and you get really good solids mixing within the reactor. And when we did a little bit of air, we noticed that our electrical heaters external to the reactor didn't need to power on as much, right? If you do a little bit of air, you can balance your oxidative reactions, which release heat, and you can balance those with the endothermic reactions, specifically pyrolysis, because it requires heat to break down the biomass components.
For our listeners, like just to kind of define some terms, though, so exothermic reactions are like fire that releases energy, heat into the surroundings, and endothermic absorbs it.
Yep.
So that's very interesting that both processes are at work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always remember exo as like heat is exiting, and then endo, N, needs heat. And what you can do is you can tune it to hit a target temperature inside your reactor. And so I started doing more and more air, and I realized in order to maintain temperature in the reactor, I needed more and more biomass to maintain the endothermic heat demand, the thermal demand inside the reactor. And ultimately, I was able to get three times as much material compared to the baseline experiments, which is 300% more, which means that I don't need, when we scale up this reactor, to be very large, like a chemical plant. It doesn't need to be so large. It could be one third of the size and still handle the same amount of material as if you weren't using air in the process. And also using air in the process also helped reduce operating costs because you don't need to have some inert gas production produced on site to be able to meet that fluidization command.
That's really cool. And just another example for our listeners, we're all everybody's probably familiar with warm hands, little products that you break open in the winter and your hands are cold and you hold them. That's an exothermic reaction that, you know, releases heat, keeps your hands warm. And then if you got a boo-boo and you need to put a cold pack on it and you've got one of those cold packs and you break it and punch it, that's an endothermic reaction and that produces cold. And so you put that on your owie, right?
Yep. Yeah, and it's important to note that we're not doing full combustion. We're only using about 5 to 10% mm-hmm. of the amount of oxygen that you would need to do full combustion. So that's one of the ways that we can say it's still pyrolysis. It's still in the absence of oxygen because it gets consumed very quickly in the bottom portion of the reactor.
And again, that goes back to high efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd say another thing for CHARM specifically that results from what Joe has developed is that the ability to have a small reactor is really critical for our long-term business model. Because the thing about all these biomass residues that we're talking about, either wildfire residues or agricultural residues, is that they are scattered and they are also very hard to transport. One of the main things that can be challenging for wildfire fuel reduction programs is what to do with all that biomass and how expensive it is to move it. But being able to develop a small reactor means that eventually our plan is to actually operate in the field. So we will either be at the field edge or forest edge, or, you know, in the interim, we operate in small pads where we have a series of, you know, a set of pyrolyzers that operate together. And that enables us to reduce the transportation costs, the carbon footprint of the transportation, as well as just the logistics of having to deal with moving all of that biomass around, which reduces costs as well.
That's very cool. So in the aftermath of a wildfire, in that fire footprint, you could actually have these pyrolysis devices deployed and do it right there on site.
Potentially, yes. And I think, and a lot of what we focus on right now is actually preventing the next wildfire, right? We work right now with, for instance, a lot of the projects that we're sourcing from currently are from Colorado's Front Range, where they are working on watershed protection by doing proactive projects to decrease the fuel load in forests, which then means that if there is a fire, the severity of it is much less, or, you know, it's much less likely to spread if there's less fuel available. So we're already doing that within, you know, a certain radius of our location in Fort Lupton, Colorado. And then we plan to, you know, be able to then operate on site as we grow.
Very cool. Well, tell us a bit, you know, both of you, start with you, Joe. Tell us about the goals of the company you work for. How do you go about doing this carbon removal and this great work, which sounds great? And then also, you know, your business, you got to turn a profit.
Yeah. The one thing that we're focused on is we're not focused on directly pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. We're leveraging the plant's ability, because it's already done that, in growing the biomass as a feedstock. But what we can do is we can use the pyrolysis process to take that stored carbon and then convert it into a liquid carbon material as well as a solid carbon material. That's the bio oil and the biochar. And ultimately, we can achieve up to about 80% of the original carbon in the biomass gets into those two products. And the bio oil, we can utilize old oil wells that are no longer oil producing, but are good candidates for oil receiving. And we can then inject our bio oil into the subsurface geologic storage and sequester that carbon unburnt in liquid form for thousands of years. And then the biochar has another, carbon removal potential where it can be used with agriculture or other industrial processes to decarbonize.
That was interesting to me when I was learning about biochar, is that it's very useful. Could you tell us about, you know, because I know you guys focus on the oil and injecting it into the ground, but just explain to us, you know, exactly what's the difference between oil and char, and what are some of the uses for char?
Yeah. When I first got into pyrolysis research, we've always been focused on basically producing biofuels from bio oil. And the main difference is that bio oil is not similar to the petroleum crude oil that you would have up coming out of the ground, which is very hydrocarbon based. There's a lot of oxygenates still in the liquid oil product. And with biochar, that solid form of charcoal, it is a lot of the carbon that has just been kind of heated and remaining from the process. And it has a structure where in the soil, microbes don't really attack the biochar. It will actually stay in the soil for years and years, and it stores a lot of fixed carbon in basically the soil matter that it can't be decomposed and generate a lot more CO2 once it's in the soil matter. Whereas the corn stalks, the corn cobs, microbes can go after those and basically decompose them and ultimately release CO2 over years.
Ah, yeah, no, that's interesting. And I also saw there's some very interesting porosity properties to the biochar. Could you maybe explain that a little bit to us? Because I found that to be, wow, you know, a little chunk of biochar that I could hold in my hand has an insane amount of surface area.
Yeah, it does. It's kind of like a mild form of activated carbon. I've seen biochar have up to a couple hundred square meters per gram in terms of surface area and porosity. And what that means is that if you think about like a piece of granite stone versus pumice stone, pumice stone has a lot more pores, and you can kind of see how, you know, if you were to put that in a glass of water, all the water would kind of infiltrate those pores. And what it means for biochar is that when you're putting that into the subs in the surface and the soil, you can increase the porosity and the water retention capacity in that top layer of the soil and make it more available for plants. It also helps prevent a lot of nutrient runoff when fertilizers are applied to land for different growing seasons. It actually helps reduce the density, right? It actually opens up, it reduces the bulk density of your top layer of your soil too, which actually allows for better like growth of the roots of plants into the soil, which allows for then more nutrient uptake and water uptake through the root pathway too.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our look at the process of removing carbon from the landscape through the creation of biochar and bio-oil with Nora Cohen-Brown and Joe Pollan from Charm Industrial, a company based in San Francisco with research and development operations in Colorado. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Hey there, good listener. Dave Shlohm here, and I wanted to thank you for listening to the podcast version of Blue Dot. Without the support of our listeners, this show would not be possible. So if you enjoy the content we provide, like this episode about biochar, I hope you'll take a moment and make a donation to the NPR member station that produces it, North State Public Radio. You can make a donation at our website, mynspr.org. And now let's get back to the show. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return to our look at sequestering carbon into the ground through the process of turning biomass into biochar with engineer Joe Pollan and policy expert Nora Cohen-Brown from Charm Industrial. I also saw that some folks are, you know, actually treat the biochar, inoculate it with organisms, or at least get nutrients in there. And it's becoming kind of an in thing to use in gardening and farming. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah. And maybe Nora can talk about some of our work with composters that are using some of our char in their processes to improve the initial nutrient delivery when biochar is actually land applied.
Yeah, Nora, can you explain that to us? Because what I saw was just putting biochar into your soil is maybe not a good idea. You have to do some things to it first.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're working with a number of different partners, primarily in Colorado, you know, local to our facility, on different ways to best use the biochar to best improve nutrient retention and to really improve soil health. And I think, you know, there's a lot of different factors that go into that, and I won't begin to to claim to be an expert on that, but I think that what's interesting is that, you know, it's had some really exciting results, which means that we're getting more and more interest from farmers in trying out different ways to apply biochar to the soil. And I think we see applications and, you know, for other things as well, like building materials, or, you know, the biochar itself has a lot of different uses. It also has filtration qualities, right? Because it's kind of because of that structure that Joe's talking about. So, you know, the biochar itself is, you know, an additional product line for us, in addition to actually selling carbon removals on the voluntary market.
And Nora, could you go into that a bit more about the carbon market, how that works, and, you know, how that works economically for your company? Like, who are the people that use your product or invest in you, in order to be a part of that market. Explain how that works, because a lot of us don't really understand it.
Yes, absolutely. So the approach to carbon removal that we're taking is a novel approach and is being supported by a number of different corporate purchasers who are really interested in what is kind of the highest value climate impact and what are ways to jumpstart the new solutions that we need as we get to a level of, you know, emissions reductions where, you know, there's a ceiling there, right? And there's a certain portion that in all of the kind of climate models has been identified as something that has to be managed by carbon removal. And in order for us to have enough carbon removal to remove carbon when we get to that point, those companies such as Charm and other companies in this category need to grow. So that they can get larger, so that the cost can get lower, so that then it can be part of a market that is, you know, at a lower price as we start to get farther along into, you know, the 2030s. And so we did an initial offtake with Stripe Climate in, I think, 2021, so quite a while ago. And that sort of was one of the programs that jumpstarted the new carbon removal industry. And one of the critical things for sort of these new technological approaches to carbon removal is that they are paired with extremely rigorous measurement reporting and verification, because these are novel approaches, and we are also claiming a very high level of permanence. So, you know, for us, because we are taking this bio oil and injecting it underground, once the bio oil is underground, it hardens over time. And so it is, you know, 10,000 years of permanence, right? It's not going anywhere. It's a thick and viscous substance. It smells like barbecue sauce. It's similar to the ingredient liquid smoke, and it kind of moves like molasses. And so it's a really, really stable way to store carbon, which means that we can make claims around how long we store it that are different from some of your more traditional carbon offsets. So as a result of that, there's sort of a very vibrant ecosystem of measurement reporting and verification protocols that goes along with these voluntary commitments. And we were one of the first recipients also of a large commitment from Frontier Climate, which is a corporate buying consortium that was established by Stripe Climate. And we also have a number of other corporate offtakes from partners like Boeing and JP Morgan Chase. And, you know, there are several other technology companies and other financial services companies that are within that portfolio. The idea is that these companies are investing early in these types of carbon removal technologies at a higher price, with the goal of getting technologies like ours down the cost curve. And for Charm, what that means is that we will continue to sell removals and continue to remove carbon, but also as the technology gets less expensive to deploy, we will also start to use the bio oil to produce other products that can be used to decarbonize other industries.
I'd like to also get back to some of the things you mentioned about wildfire and your role in that. Can you tell us about maybe some of the agencies and entities that you've worked with that have responded well to what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely. When it comes to the wildfire fuel reduction sourcing, we are generally working with projects that are quite complex public-private partnerships. So often there's a federal U.S. Forest Service component, there's a state Forest Service component. So in Colorado, that's the Colorado State Forest Service. And then there's also contractors that are working within that ecosystem. A lot of times these are large projects that are designed over a number of years that have, you know, basically a certain amount of acreage that's being treated, but they get stuck around what to do with the reduction residues that result from that treatment. And so that's where we come in, and we generally partner actually at the contractor level to do an offtake to say, we can purchase that wood from you, we can take that off your hands and use it for a beneficial use. And so Charm really can help play a role in reducing those fuels and taking them and converting them into a useful product.
Yeah, I just got back from a pretty extensive road trip doing some fishing in Northern California. and going through some areas that have been hit by some pretty catastrophic wildfires, like the Dixie Fire, the Park Fire, and looking at these areas where they're doing all kinds of cleanup of the forests, where they're, you know, trying to get things, fuel reduction. But there's all of these piles of biomass. And, you know, now that exactly. I've been talking to you, I'm thinking,
those are the piles we want.
I know what they should yes. be doing with that stuff, because, boy, there's a lot of it out there.
Yeah. One of the partners that we work with said something about how they don't actually do fuels reduction. They just move fuel around right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge. And certainly, you know, and, you know, I'm based in California. We did a pilot in California a couple of years ago with the National Forest Foundation and the Inyo National Forest around a thinning project near Mammoth Lake. It was, you know, a large scale project where they're really trying to protect the town of Mammoth by doing this thinning work. But again, they don't really have they don't have a location to put all of those residues once they've been removed. And so there's a lot of opportunity there. I mean, there's a lot of risk there. And so we're, you know, it's one of the highest priorities for us to be able to help reduce those risks by taking some of that wood off of people's hands.
Joe, I was wondering if you could maybe walk us through this, like the entire process. So let's say, you know, take us to a pile in the forest. They've cleaned up all this litter and done some thinning, and they got this giant pile. Take us from that to the end of the journey.
Yeah.
Tell us about what would go on.
Well, I can provide a kind of an example of what we do right now at our site in Fort Lupton.
Perfect.
We receive logs from the Colorado Front Range that are the wildfire fuel reduction projects that Nora mentioned, and trucks of logs make it to our site. And we do a little bit of passive drying at our site when they're just seeing sunlight and the water kind of sheds right off the piles. Ultimately, we have our own wood chipper because we need to break that log form down into a more manageable particle size for better drying. And that's a wood chipper. You know, that's basically mulching of logs in our own backyard. And once the wood chips are dry, we actually go a step further and we reduce the particle size to be more of the consistency of sawdust. And the reason why that's important is when you're trying to make bio-oil and really maximize your carbon conversion in the process, you need more surface area. Kind of like what we already talked about with biochar and the mm-hmm. porosity. The original sawdust has more surface area than wood chips. I always like to say, if you have a pound of wood chips and a pound of sawdust, which one has more surface area? It's the sawdust. Surface area helps in two fronts. One for heat transfer, because we need to take that thermal sledgehammer and break down the biomass as fast as possible. And when those volatile vapors are basically being driven out of the solid biomass particles, when you open up a wood chip and have more sawdust particles, there's just more surface area for those volatile vapors to leave and exit the particles themselves. That helps avoid a lot of secondary reactions where you can have gas solid reactions that kind of reduce your carbon conversion, and you want to steer clear of that. You'll end up making more residual gases from the process, that syngas that I was mentioning before. But if your goal is carbon conversion from solid biomass to liquid oil, you need to hit it with heat and you need to let the vapors come off of the wood particles really fast. And immediately leaving the reactor, what we do is we have a series of unit operations. And unit operations in engineering terms means it's a piece of equipment that does this one thing, and they all have to work in unison. So after the reactor, after the fluidized bed reactor, it goes through a series of cyclones to remove the particulate matter from the process stream. The cyclones are kind of like a Dyson vacuum. It just comes in tangentially, spins, and creates a high vortex velocity. And it spins the particles out of that process flow. That means you can collect your biochar particles and then move them where you want to after that cyclone. When the vapors are still hot, you need to cool them down in order to make that liquid. So we do that through a series of unit operations called condensers and electrostatic precipitators, or ESPs for short. And what we do is we cool down the vapor stream to like less than 100 degrees C usually. And ultimately we try to get down to around 20 degrees C. But what we do is we cool down those vapors the vapors turn into a liquid, but sometimes through the process flow path, the droplets don't want to drop out that easily. And so we have a combination of temperature reduction and electrostatic precipitation. And what that means is we will have a charged electrode, and we create a static electric force in the process piping, and that creates these corona points where the droplets that are moving fast through the piping become negatively charged, and then they get attracted to the outside wall, and then they drip down and form this liquid. It's a super efficient means with low power to be able to collect a lot of the harmful emissions from power plants. So it's a pretty scalable technology. And in combination of condensers and electrostatic precipitators, you can produce around up to 70% bio-oil yields from your biomass. And then we have bio-oil where we can then store it in tanks and we can move it with trucks or rail cars to strategic well locations for deep geologic storage underground.
Is the bio-oil useful for anything besides just injecting in the ground to store it?
Yeah. I've been focused on producing bio-oil for much of my research, but I would also produce bio-oil for other researchers that were trying to upgrade to biofuels and renewable chemicals. Because when you go back to all this, it is a domestic resource that has a more carbon neutral presence. When you divert it into the subsurface, you're locking it away from the carbon cycle, right? If we have a wildfire and there's uncontrolled release of carbon to the atmosphere, or even if you're taking the wildfire residues and you're doing controlled burn piles, both of those are a net emission back to the atmosphere. And you have to wait for, you know, more plant matter to pull that via photosynthesis into the stored plant matter. If you're trying to ultimately go to a biofuel and then burn it in an engine, people kind of know a little bit more about like sustainable aviation fuel, right? That's like we're trying to decarbonize a lot more aviation fuels and heavy industry and marine cargo ships. And we've seen how when you try to make regular transportation fuels that are drop-in replacements, you're also competing with electrification, right? For regular everyday vehicles. If you're ultimately trying to go to a drop-in fuel for decarbonization purposes, you could actually just decarbonize now by sequestering that carbon back underground. Or you can undergo further processing steps, which does add to your operating cost and capital cost for upgrading your bio-oil to a finished fuel. Or you can kind of take the shortcut path and decarbonize now.
Nora, can you tell us a bit about, like, what are the typical sources for the biomass that Charm Industrial uses?
Yeah, so typically in terms of sourcing the biomass, we primarily right now are working with state agencies and federal agencies and private partners that are doing wildfire fuel reduction projects where we can come into that project and source fuel from them. But we're also in the long term looking at agricultural residues as well. So we are having a lot of conversations with farmers as well, looking at things like corn stover or wheat straw, or like in California, things like almond or walnut shells. As Joe mentioned earlier, we can use any, you know, a wide range of biomass. It's just a matter of what is the volume, where is it located. We are always measuring exactly what the carbon is that's going into our process. So right now, while we operate in Colorado, for instance, there's a certain radius that we're looking within to source our biomass to make sure that we're not, that our emissions are not too high to make it worth our while. But as we get to a more mobile process, that really unlocks a lot of biomass sources that really aren't useful for other approaches to using biomass because we can actually go and operate field or forest side. So we have a lot of flexibility when it comes to the type of sourcing that we can do at scale.
Can you give us some examples of what some of those sources you'd like to access are?
Yeah, so currently we're working on, you know, things that are just within like the Boulder you know, the greater Denver Boulder watershed, but we could go a lot farther into the Front Range, for instance, as we're able to operate in a mobile fashion. Similarly, you know, there's a lot of opportunity in California. One other example is that we did a pilot with Pacific Gas and Electric a few years ago to use vegetation management residues that came from clearing power lines. So there are similar opportunities like that with utilities in different states. But I think the biggest area where being able to be mobile will be the most useful is actually in the agricultural setting where, you know, right now, generally, farms don't have the ability to transport, you know, their residues very far. They're not always used to collecting them. So, and we would never take all of the residues that are on a field. We would always take only a portion because there's a portion that's very useful for a farmer for nutrient retention. But that portion that we take from the field, being able to be mobile will give us a much broader range of access. And then similarly, you know, the forest fuel reduction projects that we can access as we are more mobile will, you know, be we'll be able to get a lot farther into the field as well.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our examination of the world of biomass, biochar, and bio-oil with Nora Cohen-Brown and Joe Pollan from the San Francisco-based company Charm Industrial. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Dave Schlom here, and we'll get right back to the program. But before we do, I wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening and supporting this program. If you've never perused our archived shows, it's well worth a look at the myriad of topics we've covered in recent years. You can do that at mynspr.org. And while you're at it, consider making a donation to the public radio station that produces Blue Dot, North State Public Radio. And now let's get back to our look at the fascinating engineering and science behind biochar and bio-oil. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. We're speaking with engineer Joe Pollan and Nora Cohen-Brown, head of market development and policy for Charm Industrial. Charm is a company headquartered in San Francisco with a research and development operation in Colorado. Charm is pioneering efforts to remove carbon from the landscape and store it permanently underground through the process of making bio-oil. You know, Europe is going through a pretty major league heat wave right now. And a lot of those places, they don't have air conditioning because in the past they didn't have these problems. I'm wondering if you're getting a lot of interest from abroad about what you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll say that the heat wave is very close to home for me as my mom is actually in France. And so she's hunkered down right now. She does not have air conditioning, but she has a system of freezer packs and water and fans. That's keeping her apartment at 83 degrees right now. So yeah, it is pretty wild over there right now. I would certainly say that there is a lot of interest in Europe as well as in Canada with, you know, carbon removal technologies and how to integrate them into their existing frameworks. And, you know, we talked earlier about markets in the voluntary market, which has been our primary focus so far. But in order for technologies like this to scale, there's going to be have to be compliance markets as well. We're seeing quite a bit of development actually in California on this front, but also overseas as well. And I think that that is something that's really important to keep in mind, that this is something that's required for us to reduce emissions worldwide. And so there will have to be government participation in, you know, sourcing from carbon removal technologies as they scale. And that's a lot of the work that I do is working on what are the opportunities to do so. But some examples are that Canada has a procurement program that they are in the process of running, and they're starting to look at how to integrate these technologies into their government climate goals. And then also the EU is doing quite a bit of work as well on this issue and, you know, already has a compliance market. And as I mentioned, California is actually in the process of a rulemaking that will start to create avenues for new technologies to be part of California's climate goals and process as well.
And Joe, I'm just kind of curious, if I was to come visit you at Charm Industrial in Colorado, what would I see there? Describe for our listeners what your facility is like.
Yeah, we have a bunch of log piles. You know, we have our logs stacked up We also have stacks of bales like corn stover, wheat straw that we're using for testing. We have shipping containers with canopy tents on top to kind of provide work areas for equipment underneath. We do all of our wood chipping on site. We do all of our sawdust generation on site. We store our liquid bio oil in totes right now, and we can stack up our totes and kind of keep a monitor on our inventory levels before we ship things out for carbon removal injection purposes. It's always a beehive of activity. There's plenty of people walking around with a purpose, right? We are doing engineering tests weekly. We have an operations team that works 24/7 to operate our pyrolyzers and generate bio-oil and biochar every shift of every day. It's pretty exciting to come out to Colorado. So if you're ever around, let me know.
I definitely will.
I would just add to that, that it's a really impressive facility. And I think it's also we opened that facility, I think, in 2022. And we have, I think, around 80 employees there now. We started with one building and we now have two buildings. And so it's really a place to see carbon removal in action that's actually happening in real time. We're one of the, you know, first companies to actually start removing tons of carbon in addition to developing technology. And we've removed more than 13,000 tons to date. And those have all, you know, those credits have all gone to voluntary buyers that have contracts with us. So I would say that when we bring visitors by or we bring elected officials by, people are just amazed to see, oh, wow, this is like a real operating facility that is showing what it looks like in action to grow a new kind of business in Colorado.
And Joe, could you tell us a bit about your team and what the different roles are and like what you guys would do in a typical day, if there is such a thing?
Yeah. So right now, we have a lot of great talented engineers. We have engineers that are focused on the process and testing. We have engineering technicians that help us turn around the equipment and perform that testing. That testing is really important to us because we want the data and results to keep iterating on the equipment itself and the designs. Because right now we are working on like single tonnage per day systems, and we are working on scaling it up to a double digit tonnage per day system. We have automation engineers, we have electrical engineers, we have mechanical engineers that are doing designs for pyrolysis systems as well as injection systems. There is a phenomenal amount of material science and engineering that goes into our lab that we've stood up in the past 6 months to understand the oil properties and the biochar properties and basically provide that feedback loop to us designing the equipment and operating the equipment and figuring out what is the recipe for all of these different feedstocks and how can we optimize it for converting that carbon from that stored biomass source to the CDR products, bio-oil and biochar.
Another interesting thing to me to consider is you're a scientist and an engineer. And when people do science, they mostly share things through research journals and things like that. But at the same time, you've got, you know, your processes, which I would assume are proprietary because it's a business and you want to protect that. How do you go about like kind of sharing with the world what you do in an effective way?
We do partner with some strategic research, like national labs, to do some research work that we can't really do everything all at once all the time. And so it's good to continue to work with different academic research groups as well as national labs. We attend similar conferences. We know people. It's, you know, the pyrolysis community is small but growing over the past 15 years. And we all kind of know each other and we kind of know what we're working on. And you can say things are proprietary, but we all are rooting for each other because there's plenty of carbon removal to go around and there's plenty of technology development left to be done. When we were talking about compliance markets, right, and driving down the cost of carbon dioxide removal, with cheap bio-oil, you can do many more things. And, you know, going back to some of my research from Iowa State University and making it so that you can operate on air and have a reactor that's only a third of the size and process the same amount of material, Those are like meaningful amounts of driving down costs that we're still focused on today in other areas.
And Joe, I'm just looking to the future in a hopeful way, I hope. What do you see as the future for your work and how it can help us address the climate crisis that we're in and in your way using your toolbox?
Yeah, I've always said that you shouldn't have to have a PhD in any engineering field in order to operate these pyrolyzers. And what I mean by that is we want to basically have this system where it's like a small biorefinery, kind of like a chemical refinery, where it has a certain level of automation where it will control itself and make sure that nothing's failing and not getting too high on temperature or pressure. And many more operators can then start leveraging the systems that we develop to generate more bio-oil and more biochar, right? And the reason why that's important is we do want to make an impact. The 13,000 tons of CDR to date that we've done is kind of a drop in the bucket, and we are shooting for many more delivered tons. We have a saying at CHARM, gigatons or bust, right? Is it scalable? And then we ask it about everything. Because a pyrolyzer, it really is the sum of its own parts. If one part keeps breaking, then you got to fix that one part in order for the whole thing to work.
And Nora, what about you? Tell us how you see the future with your work, because you've been involved with this, as you said, with climate issues for in the past. How do you see the future unfolding for you and your work with CHARM Industrial?
What I would say is that the reason that I jumped into working on carbon removal is because I saw such a unique opportunity to create policy, not just for what CHARM is doing, but for a new field in climate and to create a pathway for scale. And it's slow going, but that said, when I look back on the last few years and how much progress we've made, I do see how much we're moving forward. So I'm excited about that future. It's also not fast enough given the crisis that we're in. So I feel optimistic, and I feel like that's why it's so important to have people working on these issues and believing that we can get there. And I also see that we still have a long way to go. But one of the things that motivates me is that everyone, not just at CHARM, but in the field of carbon removal, has a lot of common ground to work together still, because even though we may compete with other companies, we're all working towards a very clear goal. And that shared camaraderie has helped to build the industry and will help us get to where we need to go.
And I don't know if this is an attention span thing or a politics thing, but could you maybe comment a little bit about how you're navigating things when people's attention maybe is not as focused on climate change as it should be?
The way that I approach what we do at CHARM is to really ground it in what is local and the impact it can make for the people in the communities that we serve. Because a lot of people are not that focused on climate right now, or, you know, have other priorities. But people do care about whether a fire is going to impact their air quality, whether it's going to impact their home. People care about the orphan well in their neighborhood that has been sitting there for years, potentially leaking methane. And so I really ground the work that we do in terms of communicating with the communities that we serve in that actual local impact and the impact that we can have while we're removing carbon. And I think that that has been very effective in this moment when I think a lot of people have really hunkered down in a lot of ways. I think we've really been welcomed in the communities that we work in, and some of those communities are not focused on climate change at all. And I think that the other thing is that we are creating a whole new category of job opportunities. What we do is very similar to saltwater injection in the oil and gas industry. And so we're able to also provide jobs to people that don't require retraining or reskilling. And so I think that that is a lesson that I hope can apply for other technologies and other areas as well, that there are a lot of impacts to climate technologies that can be kind of separated from the sort of large, really hard to grasp idea of the climate crisis. And I think it's an inroad with people who are less excited to talk about climate in their daily life.
Interesting. And Joe, Nora mentioned something just now that made me think. There are all these wells out there that are no longer in production. Could you just maybe explain to us how injecting them with this bio oil is, you know, a really good win-win situation?
Yeah, there's thousands of wells out there. Like I said, not every well is currently producing oil for us right now. They already have decades ago. And so if they're just sitting there, those are potential assets that would help us remove carbon now, right? Instead of having to create like the perfect biofuel that people will use in the existing infrastructure and markets, it's a way to decarbonize right now behind the scenes. And so we have produced many millions of gallons of barrels of crude oil. There is potential for us to store the equivalent amount of bio oil underground if we prioritize it.
Well, I want to thank you both for, you know, spending the time with us to explain this, the realm of biofuels, biochar, bio oil, and how it can help us navigate the climate crisis in the future, and what you're doing there at Charm Industrial. It's been really fascinating, and I just want to thank you both.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
Thank you so much for having us. It's great to have a conversation about all these topics.
Thanks again to our guests from Charm Industrial, Director of Pyrolysis Engineering Joe Pollan, and Nora Cohen-Brown, Head of Market Development and Policy. You can learn more about the company and their innovative science and engineering at charmindustrial.com. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler, with help from Chico State student intern, Stefan Barger. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.